Okay, while Kyla is getting set up, we're going to, you're doing just talking. We're doing mixed media. We're doing talking, PowerPoint presentation, and slides in that order. And this is a technology oriented panel. The official title is data driven decision making and technology in schools. I'm Paul Goldman, and I'm basically, my job is to stand up here and quickly introduce everybody and to alert you that everybody will be talking for 12 minutes, and the other thing I do is keep time and put up numbers to remind them when they are when the end is near and Armageddon is coming. The first paper is by Bob Johnson from the University of Utah. I'm going to read everybody, and Bob's is on the elusive challenge of realizing technology-driven schools and instruction in the move towards globalization. Second paper is by Jeff Wayman, who's over here from University of Texas at Austin, and Sam Stringfield, who's not here, leading faculties in the use of student data for instructional improvement. Third, is that right? No, actually, that's the third paper. Second paper is by Kyla Wahlstrom and her colleagues, neither of whom are here, an investigation into the daily work of principals using weblog technology. And the final paper is by Janelle Drone from City University of New York on technocentric leadership improving on-time high school completion rates for African-American students. And then when they're all done, Scott McLeod, who is sitting over there, is going to lead the discussion. So, ready to roll.
Thank you for coming. This can be a difficult time of the day to come to a session. I appreciate you coming. And let me say, first of all, my paper is distinct from the others in the sense that it's really not about data-driven decision-making. It's more about the integration of technology in the classroom, and it addresses the larger question of why is it that in light of the debate regarding technology and techno-reformers, as Cuban referred to them as, why is it so difficult to realize fully integrated technology or use of digital technology? And I use that word digital technology in a broad sense, not necessarily primarily computers, but it's much larger than that. But ask the question, why is the full integration not occurring at the speed that many techno-reformers would like for it to occur? And the perspective that I bring to the paper, it's an essay, and I have a copy of it here, sort of an essay based on my experiences and reviewing the literature. It's an organizational theory perspective. And I argue in the paper that a lot of talk about reform, educational reform in general, absent in that debate, whether it's in research literature and or just professional politicians who seek reform to build their careers on piggyback of sponsoring various reforms, is that there's an underappreciation for the organizational theory literature and for the organizational distinctives of educational organizations, both in terms of the way that they're structured, the organizational context, as well as the core technology that defines them. And sort of using that frame, and you can see it in looking through the presentations that are going to be made in this session, it's not really about data-driven instruction, though that is very important. And I assume my paper was thrown in because the word technology appeared in the title, so sort of that disclaimer. And I'm sure that the papers that follow mine will be excellent. So with that in mind, I framed the paper, as I said, it's sort of an organizational theory analysis. And using that idea, bringing those things to bear on the question, why is it that technology, fully integrated technology cannot be integrated in the instruction? And I use three concepts in the organizational theory literature, and I compare that with the debate that I see raging in the what Cuban referred to as techno-reformers or techno-enthusiasts. And I argue, first of all, that this whole idea of just this notion of technology, whereas techno-enthusiasts would define technology primarily in terms of hardware and software, the organizational theory literature, particularly the work of James Thompson, people like James Thompson and Hewlin Rosenowski back in the mid-80s, defined technology much broader than any specific tool. we talk about technology. Organizations are defined by what is known as their core technology. For example, when you talk about aircraft production, you think of organizations like Boeing or the Airbus, or if you think about computer organizations, you think about Apple. Well, the defining activities of those organizations, that's one referent for technology. But in the context of educational organizations, and educational organizations, they share similarities with many different kinds of, all kinds of organizations, I think, share some basic generic structures. But educational organizations, I have argued over the past 2 or 3 years of my research, share some distinctive features that often, that inform change strategies or ideas regarding what are the limits of a proposed change, or will a proposed change work or not. And in terms of technology, the broader definition of technology, beyond what techno-reformers would have us think, we think about the core technologies of educational organizations. We think about teaching, and teaching is a very complex technology, and core technology in that sense is defined as is the process, the know-how, the several elements, the decisions, the tool, just a whole composite of things that go in to the act of teaching. It's a very complicated process defined by, I think, probably the defining feature is the teacher making multiple judgments sort of on the spot. And whereas technology enthusiasts would say, well, the reason why technology can't be fully integrated is because teachers are resistant. And they say that because I argue in this paper that the assumption they have, the working assumption, is an oversimplistic definition of what technology is, and an underappreciation of the complexities of teaching technology, that is, what it goes into teaching. And those of you who have taught, which I assume most of you have, are appreciative of that. So that's one angle, that's one argument I make. The second point that I make in the paper is in regards to the organizational context of teaching. And I talk about the institutional history of school and how the structure that currently defines historical structure of schools, of course, were imprimaturs of the scientific management movement, and they reflect that. And when we use the phrase, what does it mean to do school? There are several things that come up in our minds. For example, we can think about the egg crate structure. We can think about one teacher before several students. We can think about the rigid bell schedule, the age-graded cohort system. And in the public minds, those have become institutionalized. And usually changes that are introduced are assessed in terms of those working institutional features that have become associated with doing school. Along with that are what I refer to are as hyper-rational myths regarding teaching. And of course that's consistent with a narrow view of technology, that teaching is something that can be easily automated, when in fact we know that teaching is more complicated than that, and it calls for structures that allow for that complexity. For example, decentralized structures historically that allow teachers to make the kinds of decisions on the spot that need to be made. Well, in that regards, we all know that, in a way, educational organizations are hypocritical in that the institutional forces that define, we're all familiar with the work of Myron Rowan back in 78, the institutional myths or the rationality that define the organizational structures belie the core technologies that occur in them and the kinds of structures that are needed to actually do that technology. So there's an inconsistency between the structure and what actually happens in the school. And what I argue is that one of the reasons, or there are several reasons, or one of the primary reasons why technology has not taken a hold is because it's a lack of appreciation for the complexity of teaching and learning. And many of the technologies that have been introduced have been developed by people who lack an appreciation of that complexity. Along those lines, I also talk about the challenges of classroom teaching, the two challenges that sort of define the focal point of teaching decisions. And whereas techno-enthusiasts would accuse teachers of being resistant, conservative, stubborn, the true focal point are, in terms of decisions regarding instruction, focus on two basic issues that define, I think, the teaching process. The first of which is, what can I do to maintain order in the classroom? And then beyond that, what can I do to motivate students to learn? And I argue in the paper that the technology of teaching revolves around those primary issues. And the repertoire or the craft wisdom that has emerged over the years reflects the efforts of teachers to deal with those complexities. And I go on to argue in the paper that the technologies that come down to the pipe often do not, the reason why teachers are hesitant to accept many of them is not necessarily because they're stubborn, even though I'm sure there's teachers out there, like in every profession, that are stubborn and will not come hell or high water, will not refrain from doing what they've working out their what they've done historically in their own careers. But the reason why is because these technologies do not facilitate the rhythm or the DNA or the instructional efficiencies and strategies that teachers have developed in the classroom. I mean, the paper is rather involved and aspects of it are quite theoretical. It's difficult to summarize, and I'm about out of time. But I invite you, if you're interested in the institutional aspects of schooling, as well as appreciation of the core technologies of teaching, I invite you to look at the paper. And I'm anxious to hear what Scott has to say about it when he facilitates the discussion at the end. Thank you. Sorry for talking so short.
All right, well. Is that high enough? Can people see it? Or should we try to put it up a little bit? That would help them. Or not? What do you think?
Yeah.
A couple pieces of paper?
Can
that do it? Well, it's a little skitty wampus, but.
Good enough.
Good enough? Okay. Well, I'm Kyla Wallstrom. And I'm the director of CARI, that's the Center for Applied Research and Educational Improvement at the University of Minnesota. And my colleague, Ann Werner, who is the first author on this paper, had a death in her family, and so she's in Michigan taking care of family business, as she needs to be. So I'm here to share with you what we have done in terms of the use of weblog and technology to understand better the craft of being an educational administrator, specifically an elementary principal. And it's interesting because, as it was just mentioned a minute ago by Bob, my paper is also not about the infusion of technology into instruction or even doing the work of a principal, but in fact, it's a technology-based way for us to have collected data. So we're ready to move forward and the telling you what we learned. Okay, so we begin with this quote. And I know you can read, but I actually, just because I was an old third grade teacher and special ed teacher, it's easier for your eyes to follow along as I read aloud. Okay? So I once sat in a session with an organizational analyst who asked us, a small group of principals, what we did on the job. He diagrammed all of our tasks and concluded that we had an impossible job in which we made decisions every few minutes with incomplete information. We all agreed with him, everybody wants a piece of us. All right, what this study was all about, and it was conducted over the course of an entire year, we invited and got three elementary principals to be willing to be participating in this study. Each of them kept daily log record of their work. And we asked them then, we have one urban, one suburban, one rural principal, and we asked them that in their blogs each day, it was a pass-protected site, these are the questions they had to address. What were the questions of the day? What was going on in the school that needed some processing? Who were the participants? Was it children, staff, parents, and so on? What were the emotions of all the people involved? And what did you do? Okay, now why did we engage in this study? Ann Werner, who is the director of our principal preparation program at the University of Minnesota, really felt that she needed to have a richer database, a richer source of information for aspiring principals. And as any of us in this room would probably attest, the texts are important, but they really are incomplete. And I'm sure many of you use multiple chapters from different texts as you teach ed admin classes, but really it's still, there seems to be pieces that you probably have to supplement with as you should, with speakers and case studies and so on. And it has to do with people's mental models of how we are looking at standards language to visualizing applications. And I did bring, or actually Anne made before she left town, copies of the paper, and I actually hauled these here, so I'm not taking them back. We've got copies of papers for everybody. All right? But in our early summary of the literature, it talks about all of the standards that we are needing to be addressing in our classes, the ISLIC standards, the NSA standards, the things from the chief state school officers, and on and on and on, and trying to find some ways to align those to better understand what we are teaching, and then how to bring that sort of in a sense of people's mental models about what is a standard and how do you make it real for an aspiring principal. All right, for the participants that were involved in this study, how did it affect them? First off, at the very end, we did ask them after a year how this was. They said their isolation of their work diminished. And that work of a principal, I was a principal for many years before I became a worker at the U of M, and it's a very isolating job. I mean, unless you have a network of people that you can really unload on, especially with some of the very sensitive things that happen, sometimes you don't even share those with your colleagues in the school district because it feels like you're vulnerable and you're sharing things that you wouldn't want to share. Sharing the unshareable, okay? There is mutual learning and support among the participants. So the three people that were engaged in this really actually found that they loved reading each other's entries and found a sense of understanding about how their work was similar to others. Personal discovery of daily reflection. Several people said, you know, I really was able to process a lot of the hard stuff that happened in the day, and I didn't take it home and keep processing on it all night long and chewing on it. It's sort of like it did something, it enabled me to let it go, and so there was a real value in that. And people who did this realized that there's a real time commitment to be journaling every day. They didn't journal during the summers or on vacation days, but in fact they were expected to journal every day. If they had to miss a day because they were incredibly busy or something of the sort, which we all are and know that they are, then they made it up and did it over a two-day period of time. Need to be able to type. One of our participants who volunteered did not tell us until about two-thirds of the way through the year that he, in fact, was not a typist. So, you know, it was the two-finger format. All right. This is very hard to read. I just wanted to show to you how what we did is all of the data was analyzed and coded. And we used InVivo. And we coded, you can see that there's a total of passages of, you add all these things up, 318 or 382 passages. But when we coded them with multiple codes, we actually had 4,200 and some different items that were coded within our database. And we looked at the top five most frequently areas that people wrote about. So participant number one, who is an urban principal, posted 150 total entries, 2,000 coded plus passages. Her first number of passages was about communication issues, as was participant number two and number three. The second one, human resources, that has to do with personnel issues, staff appraisals, and so on. Teaching and learning is a category that had to do with being the instructional leader in the building. Now, it's interesting, teaching and learning is the number two for participant number three. It falls to number four for participant number one in terms of number of passages. Could have something to do with the rural setting and how that principal designed his or her work and so on. But lifelong learning and professional development had to do with what they personally did for themselves. Again, all that details in this paper. All right, challenges with coding. Because of these, we wanted to have the standards base, we really had to understand all the various standards and how we were coding so that we could do some data inquiry or into our database using the various standards. So we had to make sure that the coding materials really let us do a good inquiry into InVivo. As things came up, the coding was emergent. We had to keep changing it slightly to reflect what we were capturing. We had to manage the number of codes. It got out of sight at one point, and we said, how do we collapse these so we get some common things? And we had to be very, very careful about protecting identities. We did have a mixture of male and female, and we had enough of their blogs that we had to be very careful so that this could be read by anybody, anywhere, and they wouldn't be identified. Okay, so inquiries into the database. We had to use meaningful descriptors, obviously, to understand. So if we're trying to understand something about power in schools, so what is it about power that we need to know? Power and parents, power and the differential between parents, or between staff and a principal, and so on. We also had to search using the matrix intersections. Like, we had to maybe look at professional development and teachers and weekends, if we want to know something about that, okay? And often we had to deal with the notion of single entries with multiple codes. Here's a quote. I first met with a handicapped child's third grade teacher about the issue and then called the parent about her unwillingness to come to school to discuss it. Okay? So that had three different codes: special ed, parent communication, and staff relationships. Okay, the database we have a lot of our information in principal preparation programs about knowledge, skills, but the dispositions piece is really not well explored. All right, few textbooks have the affective dimensions, attitudes, emotions, and values of principal work embedded in the wide variety of topics that are normally covered. And because of this, this is sort of like the piece of information that doesn't get shared as we're talking about what it is to be a principal. We did find there is the need to move seamlessly and instantly among affective demands. Anybody in this room who's ever been a principal will know that. It is an incredibly tough job. You have to be ready to move from a meltdown kid to an angry parent to somebody who's celebrating a birthday to somebody who calls, really, I'm not kidding, to a reporter who wants to know why your school's test scores, you know, that just got released, aren't high enough. And you have to be ready to handle all that, and our textbooks do not address that very well. Managing the no control is also a big issue that aspiring principals don't understand how you need to sort of have your own mechanisms to handle no control. Here's some sample entries. I won't go through it, but it has to do with how you start with the day with PTA and the child study, and then you meet with the teacher, and then you're interviewing candidates. That's just one day's entries. Principals express a lot of frustration about doing every other central office department work so that they can't implement their own visions. Again, no control. Central office has control over you. Parents often have a lot of things to say. This is so frustrating when a student doesn't qualify for any services and is getting everything we can't give him and he still is failing. It's so unfortunate that our critics aren't able to see the passion and commitment of our teachers that they have for our kids. Implications for youth. The fact that we have this really wonderful compendium of information over the course of a year, we're developing things called layered learning modules, and they're actually ways of blending text work and the blog work for students to really understand in an online fashion how to understand the principalship. We're using these for case studies. There are things that events that are in these blogs that go on for an entire year. Personnel issue that goes on for an entire year, an issue with a parent. So great case studies over the course of time. It helps us define our field experience and how we're going to be shaping field experiences for the aspiring principals. And it gives us an authentic glimpse, really, into the work of being a principal. In fact, one of Ann's students this past summer, she said, I have to take this home to my husband. He doesn't understand in any way how demanding this job is, and I've never been able to communicate it, and I think these blogs really portray the picture. So, and another person came to her and said, I don't think I am capable of handling all this. And then Anne said, I think you are, but let's talk about what's scary to you about doing the work. We're now collecting additional blogs at this moment from middle school principals, high school principals, and directors of special ed. So we're also going to be having superintendents involved, and it's doing all these things that we say we're understanding the public, we're better understanding what it means to be a leader and what blocks our good, effective leadership. So I'm done within time, and copies of the paper are available on the website, plus I have some here at the end of the presentation. So thank you. That's it. Oops, we're still going to need it. You're going to need it. Yeah, thank you. Very fast. Talk fast.
Because you're from Minnesota.
Yeah.
I can take care of that.
Okay. I'm going to just turn it off. I'll get my wire.
Sure. While we're getting my technology straightened out here.
Doesn't count against your time. It's okay.
That's good. So I could start giving my talk now and get extra minutes in. That's good.
Whatever works.
Yeah.
There you go.
I'm Jeff Wayman. I'm at the University of Texas. I've been there since January. I was previously at Johns Hopkins University and had done some work in data use while I was there. Now I'm at the University of Texas where we don't have winter. So that's a good thing. Despite that, I have a little bit of a cold and I see some people who are at the morning session. I can assure you, those of you who witnessed my coughing fit in the morning session can know that I've done everything that I can to try to prevent that for the afternoon session. That I've had water and everything. I may have to go to use the bathroom in the middle of it, but I've done everything I can. Paper today is actually about technology and database decision making. Although I would argue that these three papers, and I'm sure Janelle's also, are not as disparate as they might seem on the surface. I heard things in both of these two papers that I was like, man, I kind of wish I'd have known that when I was writing this paper. So I think they actually work together very well. My co-author is Sam Stringfield of the University of Louisville, who also used to be at Hopkins with me. And Sam couldn't make it here today, so you're stuck with me. What we know about school data use, or what the public knows about school data use, is largely wrapped up into No Child Left Behind and other accountability policies. You know, people that read the paper think that data use is about achievement test data. These achievement tests in No Child Left Behind are typically aimed to flow upward. But the actual utility of test data or of any other type of student data is going to come when it flows downward into the classrooms, into the schools, to where we can actually affect educational improvement. And so that's the sort of thing that I study, and that's the sort of thing that we were looking at in this study. If you're going to have downward flow, then you've got to involve teachers. And so the question about our study became, what helps involve teachers? How do we get teachers into doing this? How do we make this be done by people as a part of their standard day, rather than by a few unusually interested parties? If you're going to ask how you involve teachers, then eventually that leads you to the question of how are you going to lead faculties to do this? So that's what we set about to answer in this study. The study I'm going to talk about today has a larger version that was recently published in the fall issue of the American Journal of Education. That's a special data use issue that I had the good fortune to guest edit with Sam. And it's got six really good articles about data use. In this study, we looked at three schools. We contacted commercial data vendors and asked them, tell us which schools you have that are your clients who are doing a really good job in involving their faculties in data use. We got three schools that we went to visit. One of them was a pre-K through fifth, another one was a fifth and sixth grade school, another one was a middle school. And we visited them and tried to find out what these schools were doing right and what we can learn about how they were helping to use their faculties, or how they were helping their faculties to use student data. The larger study that I talked about, that's an AJE, has a broader focus and lists a bunch of components. One of those components was leadership. And so today's paper focuses more specifically and broadens out these leadership results. That's what I'm going to talk to you about today. The results, there were three main leadership themes. One of the three main themes was district support. Another was principal involvement. If you're going to talk about principal involvement, the third one was a natural follower, which is the strategies used by these principals. I'll talk about these three sets of results in the next slide. Next set of slides. The district supports were interesting in that when we talked to district personnel, we heard a strong ethnic epic of the service of technology towards supporting data use. And so these districts, all from the top of the district, supported the technology to be able to do this. And they wanted to see their classroom teachers using it. In two of the districts, they had formal data use plans that they had outlined for their district. I can't say the plans were the best that I've seen, but it made a big difference that they had some. One district did not have a data use plan, and consequently, in talking to these district folks, we discovered that the school we were looking at was about the only one in the district that was using data very much, and I thought that was probably a natural consequence. They're on their way to creating a formal district data plan. One district in particular had a very aggressive plan for bringing data down to the teachers. They had probably the most detailed district plan, and in their detailed district plan, they had an aim to involve all of the teachers. And so they had undergone some of these upfront conversations that you need to have about how are we going to do this, how can we align teaching, learning goals, standards, and things like that. So those district supports were, we felt like, facilitated the success. In terms of the principal involvement, we found in these schools that the principal was the real key. This wasn't surprising. I've just about every talk that I've ever given on this, I say something to the effect of either this stuff lives and dies in the principal's office. And we didn't see anything any different here. These principals were real real strong leaders and very much invested in these data initiatives. The way they went about it was different than what you've seen historically about principals leading for data, because these principals were trying to involve the faculty rather than trying to control everything. So they were using distributed leadership tactics. They were trying to build capacity in their faculties rather than be the bottleneck that everything comes through. And if you read some of the other literature, you can paper that Vicki Young did out of the BASRAC study talked about some schools where the principal served as a bottleneck for this data. And I'll infuse my own opinion here. I don't think this stuff is real effective unless you can help make it part of a teacher's day. And to do that, you have to build the capacity. So one of the results that we saw there was that these principals were involving the faculty. And I say there were no heroes here. In other words, these principals were not implementing the hero model. You know, the hero model we know doesn't work in leadership, to where the initiative depends on this one hero that makes everything go. I am not convinced that these initiatives will be as strong when these leaders leave. But every one of the principals we talked to was conscious of this fact. And they were consciously trying to avoid the hero model. It, as I talk about the implications later, that's one of the things we get to think about. Good quote from one of the principals said, "This is hard to do. I mean, this isn't, you know, it's not all roses. That's, we do a practice of exemplary schools, and it's easy to make it look like roses. But, you know," she said it was difficult, but she said it's just good leadership. You know, this is a thing she really believed in. We need to look at the strategies that these principals undertook, one of which was they addressed resistant teachers. You know, it's not just that everything was magic in these schools and all the teachers wanted to do this. Now, there was resistance, but they all talked about strategies that they had. They sat down with resistant teachers. They tried to pull them along. They tried to involve them in different forms of collaboration. You know, it wasn't 100%. There were still some teachers that I talked to that were like, yeah, this isn't any good, but not very many. And these principals had taken care to address this. In the paper, we referred to some of these tactics together as what we called non-threatening triangulation of data. And it's the idea that one piece of data does not tell an entire story, despite what you read in the papers. So it's the idea that we need a bunch of different sources of data, but that these data need to not be threatening too. And we wrote that you need to help teachers use data rather than be used by data. And so we saw this in force. These principals gave time to examine data. You can't make a teacher's day longer if you're going to expect this to happen. They help the teachers reflect on the practice. If you read the paper in our larger article, you see a bunch of different examples of how this happened, how the principals modeled this use and helped their teachers in using this data to connect it to instruction and actually reflect on this practice, which is what we're trying to get them to do. The final principal strategy that I'll talk about is they promoted collaboration. I've written another piece that's coming out in a book that Arnie Danzig is publishing. In fact, I think he told me it just came out 2 days ago. He's got a fireside chat about it. But we worked on a piece about collaboration and data use. And one of the things that we're finding is that they're reciprocal players, that data use informs good collaboration and vice versa. And we saw a lot of collaboration in this study. In terms of what does this mean? Well, one piece is we've got to learn better how this technology can be used to do this. And so I thought these other papers were good information towards that. As good as it seems we are with technology and delivering data, there's a lot to do with the school context that we don't know about. One of the things that is troubling me right now as I'm thinking about how we scale these to larger contexts is, yes, the principal is key. We've pretty much established that as a fact. But is that a sustainable model? The truth is that while I'm studying exemplary schools, 99.9% of the schools don't have anything going on here. And so can I take these methods and take it to the school that isn't particularly interested in this? Can I take it to the school leader who may not be as dynamic as the other leaders? Is this actually sustainable? Is it scalable? Today, I'm not so sure. But there are questions we need to answer. We need to answer questions about how better we can use this collaboration. I think it's important to talk about what we've termed calibration, which is the way these discussions about what do we mean by teaching and learning and how are we going to measure it and all go. And the big one, I talk about this not all being roses. You should have heard some of the teachers talk about this balance between testing and teaching. One of them put it very well. She said, we've gotten so much more information about our students, but are we actually teaching them anything? In that school, they had too much testing, and so where do we strike that balance, and how can we create assessments which tell us these things? I put up that slide because I'll tell you a little piece that I'm going to get into my shameless plugs here. I'm going to put the website up here so I can talk while you're writing it down. One of the things that I don't have much use for right now in our papers on data use is that so many of us report things that are going on in the schools and then don't say anything about it. Hey, this is what I went to school for, is to like observe things and then cast this in terms of previous research and what we know. And so that's why I think that previous slide was so important. Here are my shameless plugs. The shameless plug number one is a website that I've tried to maintain. It's about things data use related. Right now it's kind of dying a slow death because I haven't secured the funding to be able to spend the time on it to be able to keep it up. But it used to have a bunch of reviews that are now a lot outdated on data systems. But you can still go there and get a flavor of what the data system area looks like. Also, if you're interested in other publications, there's a publication link and so on. So you can access some of the papers that I've written, and a lot of these with Sam. The second thing I mentioned, this special data use issue that we had a chance to edit together. It's really good stuff. The larger version of our paper is in there, but it's very good. So pick that up if you can. My final point deals with my children. It doesn't have anything to do with my paper. It's just that I have your attention. And so I'm going to show you baby pictures. Those of you who saw the morning session, same joke, different pictures. So Alejandra is almost 3, Drew is 1 year old, and now you've seen pictures of my kids. That's all I have to say.
Turn that off.
Yes. Well, we're going the full gamut of technology. We began with no presentation with technology, just a paper. And then we had the PowerPoint, and now I'm going back to building a transparency. Now, I flew into San Antonio with a zip drive, and I learned this morning that there was no technology. So, between scrambling, trying to find where I could get transparency made, which I haven't used in 10 years, and then seeing that I had too many slides to present, the 4 people who were here plus the professor, I thought I need to rearrange my slides so that I could keep within the time limit. I am just delighted to be here and clothed in my right mind, as my grandmother would say. But my presentation is on technocentric leadership, and I would say ditto to everything that everyone has presented. Because technocentric is that form of leadership where they will, all of the leadership's total capacity will be driven toward making sure that technology is utilized and they have access. So technocentric leadership improving on time high school graduation rates for African American students. Now, truly, high school graduation rates is an important issue for every child, but it's critical at this point for African Americans because when we look at the national data, only 68% of the students in this country are graduating from high school on time. And when I'm speaking of on time, I'm talking about 4-year span. And I know that there are going to have to be legislation passed because there are states which say that students can stay in school until they're 21. So on the one hand, we have legislation in place that argues that students can stay in school till they're 21, but at the same time, there is a huge discussion about closing the achievement gap. So we're not going to be able to beat our chest and drag our feet at the same time. And so what I'm trying to do is to just present some information so that you can think about it. The purpose of my paper is to document that the leadership and technology strategies that I found in a program called High Schools That Work. And this program, they have employed it in their strategies since 1990. That's when this program, High School That Work program, came about. And I looked at specifically the research on this school program from the years of 2000 to 2004, and I looked at it in 6 of the Southern Region Educational Board states. Now, where are they, these Southern Educational Regional Boards, where the High School That Work programs come from? They're in 32 states throughout the Union, and if I had my zip drive, I would have all of my states up there, but here is just maybe like 24 slides of where they are, but it's all over in 32 states. So that's a huge database that we can rely on to find where these students are. Now, what I did was I looked at 6 states and to track where the high school dropouts were, and I looked at it in terms of ethnicity. Now, high school dropouts has been a concern in this country since Nation at Risk, and that's going back to 1980, but I still have not done that much about high school dropouts. But these are the states where the High Schools That Work are found. Now, the method for going about getting the information for this paper is very simple. It's an ongoing action and interpretive study of leadership and technology experiences in high schools at work. And basically, I think all of us in here have been in some portion of leadership, and all of us have had access to or gaining access to technology. So I looked at the high schools at work, I looked at leadership and technology and their experiences there. Now, as far as leadership is concerned, the research that I'm looking at to see how education is being fulfilled in the lives of African American students is based on the research of Dr. Ronald Edmonds. And one of the things that he said that we need to do is to have high expectations. And the research that's out now, according to a New York Times report called The Silent Epidemic, one of the major findings that they saw in terms of high school dropouts was that the students, that they were bored. And then there are many of the students who were in high school and who had dropped out. They said that they could have graduated, they just didn't want to go. So my method is looking at as much of the information that's out there. I did an extensive website. I looked at the state, district, and local report cards. And basically, the research is ethnographic in both intent and content. I want to know why there are so many African Americans not getting through high school. Okay, now if we look at the national average of high school graduates, we have 68% of students graduate. 50% of that 68 are African American, so we have an 18% lag. And that's a serious issue. And I think that we all know that we're going to have to use all of the resources from everyone in this room, everyone back in your school, and all of your neighbors, in order to make sure that we try to, lessen or decrease the achievement gap. And I say this all the time. I don't know if it'll ever be closed, because there's an economic factor out there that dissuades or will not allow it to happen. I give an example of why it was really clear to me in 2004, I went to Scotland to the International Arts Festival. And in the middle of a conference, we took a bus ride all the way up, and there was a kid on the bus with us, with his parents, from Long Island. This kid, we took that route all up the Harry Potter scene. This kid had read every book, had saw every movie, and now here he was on the bus going and looking to see where, how it was filmed and where it was filmed. And at that point, I said, the gap is not going to change, it's not going to close, it may narrow, but there's many other factors that will not, I don't think, in our lifetime, not say, well, my lifetime, in the over 50 game. So I think that not in my lifetime, but I'm going to do everything that I can at this time to try to make sure that there is. So there's going to be in-depth interviews with school leaders in 6 of these states. Okay. There are more than 1,000 high schools that work sites, and they're in 32 states. That's a big number. And 98 high schools in high schools that work are in 12 urban school districts. In the urban centers is where we will find most of the African American students. So that's part of the data that I'm presenting. Now, the research problem seeks solutions to improve low on-time high school graduation. And this is a very difficult task, because we have a whole generation, maybe 2 generations, of people who have not been encouraged or for some reason don't know how to complete stuff. They didn't complete their homework, they didn't complete a lot of things. I see there's a lot of 4 minutes, you're kidding. Okay. So defining the concept, the original technocentric idea is a 20th century concept. In 1980, Seymour Papert brought this idea to the forefront. And his philosophy was first to regard the beneficial effects of computer technology on learning. Technocentric leadership is a result process where the vision of technology leadership is emerged with technology. And the leadership decision making is, for the most part, rendered based on technology. Okay, today technocentric often refers to the effects of computers on society, but in the research that I'm doing, I'm looking at the research, it now is confined to the concept of education administration. So, if we're going to have the graduation rates to move closer to that 68%, the research that I'm arguing for and what we see in high schools that work is that the technocentric leaders will possess know-how in collaborative partnership, resources to recruit, retain, and promote from within. So when I present this study and paper in other forums, they said, well, you know, what about students who live in communities or live in households where they don't have technology? Well, in some of the studies some of the cases that I looked at, the resources were brought to the home and to the student by the leadership. There were laptop programs, they wrote grants, got computers that were put stationed in synagogues in a fire station, and in a local girls and boys club. So students who did not have access to technology or computers at home, the leadership was able to get, form partnerships with the community and bring the technology there. That's a technocentric leader. Okay, well, I see that I'm just way out of time, but I want to show you some of the findings. Some dissertation has been done on, you know, this whole notion of moving, closing the achievement gap. At Sam Houston State, a doctoral dissertation I found by Dr. Judy Nichols, she found she did an analysis of the motivation of at-risk ninth grade students, and it was really critical to this work, because if we're going to make sure that they graduate in 4 years, we have to count from grade 9 to grade 12. And what she found in her research, and I want to share it with you, is that students who had access to technology, the leadership, the classrooms were completely technocentric. Students enrolled in online courses, that's a main motivator for moving them toward completing school in 4 years. They valued eccentric goals orientation, they earned higher grades, they assumed greater autonomy and control over their own lives and learning, and they appreciated earning additional course credit, enjoyed completing work during the week. That last one, enjoyed completing work, is how I want to end this presentation, because I want each of you to just try to think about how you can go back and support and encourage students. I would just demand that they complete their assignments, complete reading the book, complete doing every task that they are assigned, because if they do not, it is, as the theme of the conference is, a contested intersection in terms of democracy. Thank you very much. I do have papers.
Hi everyone, my name is Scott McLeod. I'm at the University of Minnesota. I'm an assistant professor there, and I'm also the director of one of UCA centers, the Center on Technology Leadership, which we call CASEL. Depending on your perspective, I'm either the worst or best discussant in the history of UCA, because I don't really like to talk much. My general belief is that probably nobody in this room came to this session because I was the discussant, but rather because of the speakers and the papers that were here today. So I'm just going to speak for just a moment on each paper, and then we're going to open it up for questions, and I am going to exercise my privilege as a discussant to ask the first question, and then we'll go from there. I'm also going to just highlight now, so I don't forget later, that you know, one of the classic classroom teaching techniques is when you're having discussion in classes, you pass around an object and only the person who has the object can ask the question and talk. So, but instead of a teddy bear or a Nerf ball or a you know, plastic microphone or whatever, we're actually going to pass around the iPod with the voice recorder, because we're podcasting this session. And so know that when you ask a question, you'll also be on this little device, and later we'll be on the web. So I'll be hustling around, passing that around as we ask questions. Okay, so as the technology guy, I love these papers. And I'll start with Bob's. I just want to say one of the things I really like about Bob's paper is that it does something really important, something that actually some of us technocrats have been talking about for a long time, is that we have to help non-technology oriented faculty understand the expertise that they can bear into the technological realm. Because we have a lot of expertise in organizational theory and staff development and leadership and so on, and yet people who do work in that area, you know, I'm an expert on the principalship, I'm an expert on the superintendency, I'm an expert on school finance, I'm an expert on org theory, most of them haven't seen yet their intersection with the technology aspects and technology leadership. And so we really need those people to bring their expertise in and see that in many ways it's just new lenses on old issues and new lenses on old problems. So, you know, in school law, you know, there's all this hubbub about kids making offensive websites. but that's actually the same old saw of off-campus speech, just applied in a new lens. So let's bring those school legal people in and say, well, hey, you know what? We know about this. So now, so the fact that Bob is taking that org theory background and mapping it into the technological realm is a very important contribution. I just want to note that. And I'll save my question for you for later. The reason I like Kyle and Ann's paper, not just because they come from Minnesota, is that, you know, journals have been done before, but the nice part about the blog is that they also capture the voice of the practitioner. And they do so in such a way that's very authentic and helps you capture the ebb and flow of what's happening during the school year. And I really enjoy reading that and feeling about that. The other cool part about the blogging that wouldn't happen with a personal diary on paper is the fact that it can be shared. So they had this communal group, right, but because it was on the internet and it was password protected, that they could all get to that and learn from each other and see what each other was experiencing. And the blogging, the technology enables that to happen in a way that the paper wouldn't do. And then, of course, the piece where the focus from the journals and the blogging around the fact that, you know, there's some stuff happening here that is really important for pre-service administrators to know, but we don't really talk about much. Things like, yeah, you got to be mentally dexterous. You know, how, you have to be able to deal with emotion-laden, multifaceted problem solving. You have to have the stamina to deal with this stuff. You know, that's not traditional leadership instruction. So that's all the good stuff that I got out of there. Jeff, of course, hammers home the importance of principles in terms of making this happen. The issue that I always have, of course, is how do we ramp up those exemplary principles to scale? How do we get those other principles moving and doing the same kind of things that the exemplary ones are doing? And so, you know, I don't know if that means professional learning committees for principals, where they have a chance to interact with each other and learn from each other, just like we're asking the teachers to do so, or whatever. You really highlighted the emphasis of data safety, that it has to be safe for teachers to look at the data, and I think that that aspect is really under-neglected in the literature. And yet, the underpinning of everything, because you can throw all the data you want at staff, but if it's not safe, forget it. And then just this idea of the importance of technology as one of the crucial factors in terms of facilitating teachers' time and efficiency, but also to build capacity. There's this guy at Minnesota, his name is McLeod. He says, if you can do data-driven decision-making without technology, but it's awfully difficult. And I think that we see in a lot of schools that they're trying to be more data-driven, but they're not putting the necessary technologies in place to make it happen for teachers, and thus we're seeing a lot of very rational resistance. Janelle, just, you know, the piece that really pulls for me is this idea of this value of online learning for these students that may be unsuccessful in traditional school setting. I think we're seeing that as online learning opportunities continue to grow at an incredibly fast pace in K-12. You know, like the number of students who are taking online courses in high schools are doubling every year, for example. Is that, you know, the individualized pace, the better engagement with the material, and just the ability to engage kids that in this setting, the traditional setting, are not successful. We're finding that when you put them in a different place, in a different way, they can still be successful. And so to move that way. All right, so that's it. I talked fast and probably longer than I intended to. So Bob, I'm going to throw out my first question to you, which is this. I think your paper does a really nice job of talking about the fact of all the rational reasons that teachers resist some of these technological initiatives. But the bottom line also too is that society is changing quickly, whether teachers want it to or not, right? And so as society changes quickly and schools change slowly, that gap increases or the irrelevance grows. And Jack Welch has this great quote where he says, if the change of pace outside exceeds the change of pace inside, then the end is near. And so my question for you, Bob, is that from an organizational theory perspective, how can we help schools move more quickly and be more adaptive to this unbelievably rapid pace of change that's occurring in the society that surrounds them, so they don't become completely irrelevant in terms of what they're preparing kids to do in terms of what the future society and workforce needs? So that's my question. Thanks.
You're going to answer.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, thank you. Sorry, totally distracted my brain. All right, fire away, Bob.
Well, Bill, I think, or is it Scott? I think it's inevitable. I mean, I think it's inevitable. It's something that it's going to come whether teachers accept it or not. I think what we can do, though, and this is the point I'm making in the latter part of the paper, is that those who have expertise in technology need to design, be more sensitive to the working rubrics that teachers use in classes to make instructional decisions. I think all conscientious teachers, I think most teachers are in a continual scanning mode in search of increased instructional efficiency. efficiencies to do their job better, quicker, students learn better. And I think the key is for technology developers, I think there's a need for greater communication, but I think there's a need to pick up on the rhythms, the what Tyke and Cuban refer to as the DNA or the organizational contours of the classroom and the school, and be sensitive to those in driving the in designing product. I think regardless of how sophisticated all the bells and whistles that come with any technological device, when it boils down to it, teaching is a highly personal, interactive activity, and technology needs to support that. So I would, that would be my response to that.
Great.
Thanks, Scott.
Yeah. Man, that was embarrassing. So locked into my own brain. So okay, so let's open the floor for questions. So who's got a question for one of our very fine speakers? Yes.
Tell me what you've been thinking about in terms of technology and data and students, because what I note is that we teachers don't know how to use data, but we completely leave students out of the picture. And so students, A, very often don't even know what, even our own students, don't know what the purpose of today is, what are we trying to accomplish, and B, have no benchmarks, and C, when there are data collected, it's not shared with the students, so they're not tracking their own piece, they're not dissecting their own test to see, oh, I'm strong here, but I have some weaknesses there. Anybody have any thoughts about how we, or places that might be doing it, and how we use it?
All right, you're next.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. You're right, it isn't a very common thing that that these technologies are used for the teachers to talk with the students about it. In fact, in our particular study, we didn't see a lot. I talked to a couple of teachers who were doing that. I have seen that in a couple of other schools that I've visited. And those schools said that it worked really well. They were excited about it. My personal belief on that is that it's a good tactic. And I think it's a thing that we should strive to do. Amazingly, I think that as little as we know about how teachers use data and as little as we've prepared our teachers to use data, I think we even know less about this. And I think it's job two, is what I think. I think job one is getting our educators ramped up, and job two would be helping our educators help the students get ramped up. That's a really long professorial way of going, yeah.
I agree. So Stiggins talks a lot about assessment for learning and helping kids get information that helps them learn, and tracking that data is one aspect. Tell us what you're doing.
What we're doing? Well, I'm an elementary principal and in a school that was designated as being in corrective action. So we were mandated to do a reform model. You might be familiar with the Baldrige framework. And we had no choice, but basically we spent our first year training our teachers to use data and building the classroom system where students would use their own data to set goals, and we focused on our two areas that needed improvement, reading and math. So every student had a goal, and we were doing short cycle assessment to check whether they were making progress. They were charting everything from kindergarten through fifth grade, charting. We had charts out on the hallway so we could chart by grade level. And then, of course, teachers were continuing their training. And this year, we're now moving from a classroom system to the whole school system, looking at data like attendance data and that kind of thing. So we are using it, even at the elementary level. But it's not everywhere.
Cuba, New Mexico.
Cool. All right, over here.
I can use my teacher voice. Oh, in some of the schools, several of the schools that I looked at, the data was students-based and student-centered. In one particular school, and this is in New York City, and where it perhaps wouldn't have the same system of tracking students' progress, they had an automated system of checking the attendance that was connected to the student's ID. When they came into the building, they swiped their card, and that allowed the school to know that they were present. And there's no locks on the doors, but the minute the bell rings, the doors locks, and if the student can get into the classroom, but in order to get into the classroom, they have to slide their card in the door, their ID. That registered that they were tardy, which registered that they needed to go to to the detention center, which registered that they needed some other type of program. So there is an automated system that tracks students' movement. It was brought into that particular school because it was designated as one of Mayor Bloomberg's schools that was you know, violent. So it tracks data, everything.
You want to respond?
Okay. Just like to respond about the use of data, and it's very interesting, the schools that I've been involved gathering data for another research project, and the principals who they themselves, and it's just it's so right on the button with your paper, the principals who themselves are comfortable with data
mm-hmm.
are the ones who really enable teachers to be comfortable and have that expectation. Because I think too often the expectation isn't made of the principal, of their teachers, his or her teachers. And frankly, if that principal can't walk into a teacher's classroom and say, let me see the list of the reading scores from last week's phonics test. And the principal who's aware of this, and I have an elementary background, but that has to be done at the high school too, so that the principal can walk in, and it isn't threatening to the teacher, say, oh yeah, you know, I'm really concerned about so-and-so, he didn't do very well on the chemistry test. Or these students are really not functioning well based on this data. And teachers collect data all the time, and we know this, but somehow they don't seem to realize that that needs to be formally used in terms of lesson planning, and principals need to hold them accountable for that.
Okay, let's take another question for our esteemed group. Who's got a thought or question?
Nobody has a question.
Comment away.
Yeah. Like, again, like a true professor, that you know the definition of a professor is somebody who talks in somebody else's sleep. And so I'm about to give an answer to a question nobody asked. One of the things that I wish I had back in my talk is I wished I would have focused a couple of more points on the technology. And one in particular that I wanted to talk about regarded Bob's paper when, and you reiterated this point later, when he was saying that these the service of these pieces of technology has to be in terms of what goes on in a teacher's day. And these data technologies that I studied, one of the things that I've observed is that these things are a perfect fit for that if they're well implemented. I mean, they're things that deal with the rhythm of what goes on in a teacher's day. They actually help shorten a teacher's day because they deliver information. They give a lot of value added. And so when I heard your paper, I was like, I need to be referencing some of that stuff.
Well, and I'll add to that, because I do a lot of data stuff and tech stuff. You know, here's what we don't do often enough. We don't go to teachers and say, what are you already collecting? And let's figure out a way to drop it in some other place other than your grade book so that it's more useful to you, right? So for example, if let's say that you're doing the 6+1 writing traits rubric. Well, that's great. You want to score those papers, just like you're always doing. But you know, if you dropped all your scores into an Excel spreadsheet and the next teacher dropped all their scores in an Excel spreadsheet, then all of a sudden with a few clicks, you can start to say, oh, look, our kids are low in organization, you know, voice is an area of concern. Because you have that aggregate and the only difference is that you put it in a different place and went click, click. And it's just that simple. And we don't do that often enough for teachers. So we impose these large external data systems upon people, and rather than coming to where they are and saying, look, this can add value even to what you're already doing and let you think about what you're doing in ways that are useful and helpful to you. So.
Also, I'd like to add, like in teacher aspiring leadership programs, one of the things that I'm doing is that I am making sure that my aspiring leaders incorporate technology into their papers. I'm not accepting, you know, long essay type papers. I know you can write. How can you go into a database and align the assignment with information in the school report card, for instance, attendance, and looking at the whole budget piece, how much money is allocated for these experiences, looking at like schools and dislike schools and analyzing the data at that point, and if we prepare them in the leadership programs to start analyzing the data, when they get into their positions as leaders, they're going to require it. But I think it's going to be a leadership criteria that everyone's going to have to employ.
What else? Yes, sir.
I just want to
go ahead, you can start.
Yeah, I was just want to make a comment.
And you're going to have the last word.
I'm going to have the last word, okay.
Tonight.
I don't know what the last, okay. My name is Jimmy Adams. I'm from a community college, and, you know, so I'm dealing with college students. So I think when you get into this technology, this right here is one of the ways we're going to have to start communicating, also with our cell phone, with text messaging. So if we use those two mechanisms, I think we can get students more involved, and also I think the your faculty too can get more involved also.
Okay, you get closing statement.
Well, okay, all I can say is thanks to Scott and to the panelists. I don't think every session we walk out of a room like this and saying, wow, that was wonderful. But I think everybody, you know, who's in the audience here is going to be saying, wow, that's wonderful. And we're going to be telling people we sat in on something that was really special today, and I sure enjoyed it, and I hope you all did.
We have papers. Put these up here.
Thanks so much.
Papers are up here if you want them.